This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, November 13th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, Roby Brock hosts a political roundtable to discuss the problematic launch of healthcare.gov. Also, Siloam Springs creates an online farmer's market.
Plus, the Artmobile rolls into town. Three things you should know about philanthropy and more.
But first, Republican gubernatorial hopeful Asa Hutchinson is releasing details about his proposal to cut the income tax rate for some Arkansans. Hutchinson said yesterday that if elected, he would seek to reduce the income tax rate for people earning between $20,000 and $75,000. During a press conference, he said neighboring states have lower taxes, which are drawing businesses that might move to Arkansas.
Not only are we not competitive right now, but you also have some governors in these other states that realize the advantage and are still trying to reduce their taxes even more. And so we are not competitive. This makes a difference for Arkansas, and we have to make progress in reducing our state individual income tax.
Hutchinson says the cuts would cost the state about $100 million, which he believes could be covered with existing growth and surplus funds. The state Democratic Party counters the plan would actually cost $150 million and jeopardize balancing the state budget. Hutchinson is seeking the Republican nomination against Little Rock businessman Curtis Coleman and State Representative Deborah Hobbs. Former Congressman Mike Ross is seeking the Democratic nomination.
Just more than 9% of registered Fayetteville voters turned out to vote yesterday on the issue of using hotel, motel, and restaurant tax proceeds to partially fund construction of a regional park and the Walton Arts Center expansion project. According to the Washington County Clerk's Office, 4,313 votes were cast in yesterday's special election. 3,704 of those votes, or nearly 87%, were cast in favor of paying off existing debt for construction of the Fayetteville Town Center. Nearly 85% of votes were in favor of issuing $6.9 million to the Walton Arts Center's expansion project. And more than 85% of voters were in favor of issuing $3.5 million to the regional park project. Terry Trotter is the chief operating officer of Walton Arts Center. She says that she and other Arts Center officials were thrilled when the poll results were announced last night.
You know, it was great to have such overwhelming support, and, you know, I think that the people are really looking forward to what the future holds for Fayetteville. I mean, these are two great projects. I think, you know, what we're doing on the expansion and renovation here is really going to transform Dixon Street yet again. And of course, the regional park's exciting too.
Trotter says now that the public funds are committed, private fundraising is one of the next steps for the expansion project.
You know, we have a lot of funds to raise for this, and we'll be, you know, working to continue to talk with people about the vision that we have for the future and get people excited about that. We are also working with our design team to continue developing the project. One of the things that will be, you know, interesting and challenging about this project is we don't want to shut the facility down. I mean, we don't want, you know, to not have a season at Walton Arts Center. So we're going to have to figure out how to do the construction while we continue to operate. So, you know, beginning to figure out how that will happen is another next step for us.
The summer months of July through September are typically lighter on programming, and Trotter says those months will likely be used for the heavier demolition and construction work. But the construction schedule won't be finalized until a general contractor is hired for the project. The overall expansion project is expected to be completed by 2016.
Springdale Alderman last night agreed to spend a total of more than $189,000 on new bleachers and bleacher shade covers for city parks. The purchase is meant to upgrade aging bleachers at the baseball and softball fields at Tyson and J.B. Hunt Parks. The money for the purchase will come from park construction bonds approved by city voters in August of 2012. Bentonville officials yesterday broke ground on the city's new community recreation center. The 80,000 square foot facility will include an aquatic center, fitness center, dance studio, gymnasium, community rooms, and more. The $16.1 million project is being paid for with public and private funds, and construction is scheduled to begin after Thanksgiving and take about 18 months to complete.
The University Libraries Department at the University of Arkansas has acquired personal and professional papers of former Arkansas politician Ray Thornton. According to the university, Thornton served as Arkansas Attorney General, State Supreme Court Justice, and President of the University of Arkansas and Arkansas State University. He also served from 1973 to 1979 as U.S. Representative for the 4th District, and again served from 1991 through 1997 as U.S. Representative for the 2nd District.
John Brown University's women's soccer team is advancing to its first title match since 2010. Yesterday, during the Sooner Athletic Conference Tournament semifinals, sophomore goalkeeper Kristen Morrissey made two saves, and junior Rachel Harris scored the game-winning shot as second-seeded John Brown tied third-seeded Wayland Baptist 2-2 before advancing in penalty kicks 4-3. John Brown University will travel to top-seeded Oklahoma City on Friday for a 6 p.m. start time.
Expect clear skies tonight with overnight lows from 21 in northwest Arkansas to 26 in the Arkansas River Valley. Warming up a bit tomorrow to mostly sunny skies with highs near 56. Tomorrow evening, partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers. Overnight lows from 35 in northwest Arkansas to 38 in the Arkansas River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. Developments in the healthcare arena this week included the president apologizing for the poor rollout of healthcare.gov and news that the state's private option is seeing some early enrollment success. Recently, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas organized a political roundtable with commentator and GOP strategist Alice Stewart, Arkansas Times associate editor David Ramsey, and Stevens Media columnist and Talk Business contributor Steve Bronner. During their conversation, Roby asked Alice if the president appearing on national television to apologize for the debacle of the healthcare.gov launch was enough to mollify his critics.
Did he say he was sorry?
I think that was point blank.
If he likes that apology, he can keep it. Period. I think it was not sincere, and I think it was what he said three times in that statement was, I regret the situation the American people have found themselves in, like they woke up in some drunken stupor at the end of the Obamacare train wreck. He led them down this road. He led the American people down this road based on those promises, and now the American people are finding out that he was not being factually accurate and being misleading by saying, if you like your doctor, you can keep it, and by saying that it will be less expensive, and by saying that you can keep your insurance company. So he led the American people here, and he owes more than apology. He owes the truth.
Democrats seem to be blowing back a little bit on this whole week of political events in Washington, D.C. David, what do you think it's done for them?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, the key issue is that healthcare.gov needs to be fixed and needs to be made to work. The goal that the administration has laid out is that it will be functioning by the end of this month. If that happens, then that changes the dynamic quite a bit. Because right now, what you have happening is you have folks that, you do have 5% of Americans shop in the individual market for health insurance. And some of those people are seeing plan cancellations. Now, of those folks that have their plans canceled, some of them may end up saving money in the end, some of them may end up with better coverage, but you have a dynamic right now where you have this asymmetry where the cancellations are coming in, but then they can't get onto the website. So that's sort of a political perfect storm. Now, if the website is working a month from now, and then all of a sudden millions of people are gaining health insurance, I think that will change the dynamic pretty dramatically. And the interesting thing to watch is come January. If the website is working and suddenly lots of people have health insurance, what we've been hearing over the last month basically is an argument that, you know, in no situation can we ever have someone who has a plan now lose it. Well, come January, there's going to be a lot of people who have plans through Obamacare, and it's going to be an open question whether the notion of simply repealing Obamacare entirely is going to work for a party that's been saying basically no one can lose their plan. Go ahead.
Well, Steve, go ahead. You've written on some healthcare for Talk Business. You've also are obviously deep entrenched in watching this debate unfold as a columnist. What's your sense?
Well, it's tough for Democrats in red states right now. You've got Senator Pryor went out of his way to let us all know that he told the president during their two-hour meeting how disappointed he was. You're talking about a fundamental remaking of a major part of the economy. That's a tough thing. On the other hand, if you can't make a website work, how are you going to do this? I think that that Democrats are who are up for a tough re-election, like Senator Pryor, are truly hoping that something gets going pretty quickly on this, because he's really doubled down on this. Mm-hmm. He has. There's no way he can run away from the vote for Obamacare, and so he said, he's talking it up. And at now, at this point, there's nothing to talk up right now, so it's got to start working pretty soon if Democrats in these red states are going to be able to hold on their seats.
I think that's the tricky part about trying to do analysis now, is that, you know, for all of the political posturing, if it's a complete failure, if healthcare.gov never works, then obviously this is an epic political disaster for Democrats. If it's working a month from now and people are signing up for health insurance starting on January 1, then this is going to look a lot more like we overreacted, this was a blip, that kind of thing.
An important note to what Steve said about Senator Pryor is that it's one thing now all of a sudden he's outraged and wants to represent the American people, but he, as Steve said, he voted for this, and the problem that we're in, he was the deciding vote on Obamacare, but it was just recently where he said this is a tremendous success story. So
the Democratic senators were the deciding vote on Obamacare, weren't they?
Okay.
Okay, I got all of them.
No, so. but the key is he went from voting for it to saying it was a success story. Now that the administration has basically given these Senate Democrats up for re-election in these red states like Begich and Landrieu and Senator Pryor, they've basically given them the permission, okay, you can speak out against it now because we realize that this is a colossal failure. So it wasn't until they got the approval from the administration that he can say, okay, we really need to fix this.
I think we should be clear about what this is, though, when we say this is a colossal failure. It is clearly possible to build a functioning website that does what this is supposed to do. They screwed up, and I think that anyone that doesn't acknowledge that is not being honest. The website has been a disaster. If the website starts functioning, then you have a completely different dynamic in which millions of people are signing up, gaining coverage. Many of those people will be getting subsidies. And if you start talking about repealing Obamacare, you're talking about taking that away. I don't mean to beat a dead horse here. I know that, you know, sort of as we're having this political discussion, we want to figure out what does it mean right now. But for Mark Pryor, for example, you know, if the election was held today, healthcare.gov not working would be a disaster for mm-hmm. him. If healthcare.gov starts working, then it's a completely different situation come November 2014.
Let's talk about the private option too, because we got some news this week that the private option has enrolled like 50,000 Arkansans here in Arkansas, which they're clearly not enrolling through the website. Where are these people coming from?
So, and it's actually 70,000 people have applied. Mm-hmm. Of those 70,000, 60,000 have been deemed eligible. DHS has already figured out that they qualify for the private option.
Where are they coming from? Where are these applications coming from?
So a few different places. The main place is that DHS did a direct mail campaign. So they had folks that they identified as people that were already DHS clients that they knew qualified for the private option, and they sent them letters. By the way, this is the kind of thing, you know, when we talk about the healthcare exchange, they wanted to do, direct mail was part of the outreach that they wanted to do, but so far, at least, that outreach money has been blocked. But on the DHS side, they sent letters out to people. People responded, and they were basically pre-approved in terms of the fact that they qualified. And it was a pretty amazing success story. I mean, usually with direct mail, you might get a 2 or 3% return. They basically, I mean, almost, I think for every letter, they got maybe a 50% return on people
David
responding.
Ramsey co-opting Mark Pryor's amazing success storyline right there.
Yeah, well, and it was. I mean, and I think one thing that we should say, though, that to be clear, what's happened in Arkansas so far is that the private option part of the Affordable Care Act is going swimmingly. The healthcare.gov, the other part of Obamacare, isn't really going at all at this point.
How does it play out in the elections next year or the budget session next year? The private option's a very contentious issue, particularly in Republican circles. Steve and then Alice.
Well, it's difficult for Republicans because this is kind of their baby. They are the ones who came up with this idea. And now they say that they did it because we're playing the hand we were dealt, and they are right to say that. But the thing about the private option is that it has to be approved year after year after year with 75% of the vote. And some of those folks who voted for it got primary opponents. And some of them are kind of backing away from it right now. Now that we have 50,000 people who are already getting enrolled, you know, it's going to be hard to say, to vote against this now and say we're going to take away health insurance for 50,000 people. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, politically, this is a rough thing to be for. So I think that we're going to see, it'll be interesting to see this, these next two sessions, if it takes root.
Now, that's not going to stop a primary opponent from coming after some Republicans in those primaries.
And that's the key. Now, there are a lot of folks that are running for election now or a re-election now that voted for private option or at some point have showed some kind of indication they supported, and they either have an opponent, primary opponent now, or they will, mm-hmm. because there are people working behind the scenes. If anyone supported private option, they're going to have a primary opponent, and that's going to be something they're going to pay the price for. But going forward, moving forward in this fiscal session, there still has to be some funding that they have to approve that goes along with this. And there's a lot of the legislators, if healthcare.gov and the Obamacare continues the way it is, they're going to stand back from that.
The fiscal session, though, however, is going to be like the month, but those votes are going to be the month before the filing period opens.
Right.
So it'll be an interesting dynamic.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas, speaking with commentator and GOP strategist Alice Stewart, Arkansas Times Associate Editor David Ramsey, and Stevens Media columnist and Talk Business contributor Steve Bronner. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Mitchell Williams Law Firm employs nearly 80 attorneys at offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at mitchellwilliamslaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at AECC.com.
I'm Eric Glass. A cop pulls a guy over because his van is swerving across the road.
Standing next to the man was a chimpanzee. The man said he was doing really well, and then he lost control of the van. And I'm like, lost control of the van? Like, at what point was the chimpanzee really in charge of this thing?
Some stories just don't fit under the daily news shows. This American Life.
Listen Sundays at 10 a.m. to KUAF.
Monday and Tuesday of this week, a colorful semi-truck has been parked in the front lot of Woodland Junior High School in central Fayetteville. This morning, the trailer, bearing the bright pink words, Go Gallery Artmobile, moved south to Ramey Junior High. The Traveling Museum is a program of the Arkansas Arts Center in Little Rock and has been bringing themed exhibition works from the center's permanent collection to towns across Arkansas for over 50 years. Thanks to a grant from the Star Foundation, it has made this trip to Fayetteville and will return again at the 1st of December and in the spring, all the while making many other stops in our listening area and beyond. Virgil Lawrence is the docent with the AAC's Artmobile, a job he has had for 27 years. Speaking to upwards of a few hundred thousand people in his career.
When you factor in events like the State Fair, River Fest, festivals that we go to, you know, you can see thousands in a weekend in some cases. You know, you can see, this is one of the, and I'm not saying this in an exaggerated sense, this is probably one of the most used items in the state of Arkansas simply because it is mobile. I mean, by being mobile, I mean, you can really take it to the masses in that sense.
In his two-day visit to Woodland Junior High, he estimates he has spoken with 300 students, a little less than half of the school's student population, seeing kids from art and career orientation classes. Though the Traveling Museum visits libraries and festivals, visiting with school children is most definitely one of the Art Center's missions. Developing a curriculum for elementary and secondary students. Though Lawrence is most often the face for the Artmobile, planning the exhibits and lessons each school year is a collaborative effort.
Generally, that'll involve a variety of people from the exhibition staff, the curatorial staff, even the facilities manager. Because all of this has you know, there's got to be various departments involved in making it a success, from the man that drives the truck down to the location of the location to what has to be repaired and fixed.
A quick glance at the Artmobile's website shows the suggested lesson plan for this Art of Story exhibit, encouraging students to think of visual artists as storytellers. The lessons provide a disclaimer that they meet Common Core state standards, which go into effect next year. Though 20-year art teacher at Woodland, James Kunzelman, says art has always been Common Core.
In English class, students look for theme in what they read. We create theme in what we make. In English, they compare and they contrast literature. In art, we compare and contrast visually. So we do the same skills, and we always have. In the curriculum guide, this exhibit is all about storytelling, and that's what we do in art every day. We are meaning makers. We tell our own story. We show other people ourselves visually through art. It's a different language than verbal language, and we do this every day.
Mr. Kunzelman says he really likes the curriculum guide that teachers receive because it isn't just for art teachers. It's for all teachers so they can incorporate the arts into what they do every day in their classrooms. Lawrence and Kunzelman move to a colorful work that hangs to the left of one of two doors into the Artmobile as Lawrence begins a short lecture.
Flute Player and Dog by Irving Amen. Because a woodcut functions very similar to a linoleum cut, I believe, that you're doing in the classroom.
Yes.
You know, the technique and the principle is pretty much identical. It's just a different kind of medium that the artist is working in. But here would be a good example. I like to emphasize to students the relevancy of what is taught in the classroom that you can come in the Artmobile and see practical application. So a student would look at this and say, well, gee, we are now currently doing something pretty much what we see that this artist did. So that relevancy of how to connect with what he's doing in the classroom, the fundamentals, the design process, procedure, and then you can see that reinforced. And I think that is a neat thing for a student to see that reinforcement, that it's not busy work or something that he's teaching. You can see how it is practically, that it is applied in a practical sense in that way. And here is a good example.
It also reinforces what the English language arts teachers do in their classroom, because this tells a story. It tells a visual story, and that makes storytelling relevant across all subject matters or courses.
The bright piece of a man playing a flute with a dog frolicking beside him is one of about 15 pieces inside the trailer, though it is the only one of this medium. Exhibits always showcase a variety of art forms, from painting, photography, drawing, printmaking, sculpture, in order to give the viewer a variety of forms and media. From something as simple as a pencil drawing to items like a fork that have been upcycled to form a sculpture. Lawrence says he has received a lot of great feedback from the students in the last 2 days, from romantic interest stories, stories of the Civil War, to how to make art and to how to formulate and use design elements. But in a story he tells from a visit to a school last week, he recalls one third grade girl that made numerous comments during the tour, though her teacher said afterward she rarely speaks.
But for some reason they see something in here or they feel comfortable to speak. And that happens every now and then, and I could think, well, that's kind of a neat concept that there's something in here that motivated the kid to come out of whatever shell they were in, that they felt like they could comment and talk about it kind of in an uninhibited way. And I think that is we were talking about this just a while ago, the kind of the uniqueness of the Artmobile, because it is maybe of a less kind of formal way of looking at art.
It truly brings the art to you, showing that art is everywhere and for everyone, that it is democratic. When the Artmobile started over 50 years ago, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art most definitely did not exist, nor did the smaller venue, Art Center of the Ozarks. And travel from rural and other areas of Arkansas to the Arkansas Art Center in Little Rock was not as convenient as it is today. School bus field trips were not quite so common. So how is it that the Artmobile is able to remain a benefit to the community as advents like the internet bring art directly to the viewer? Lawrence says it is the novelty of it.
You know, there's so few of these still in operation in America, and to think that Arkansas has had one for over 50 years now, continuous, and we travel the entire state where some art mobiles may only travel within a county or a region. I mean, we go statewide and even out of state on some occasions.
A quick internet search turns up one art mobile in Montana and one in Massachusetts. Again, that was a quick search.
So it's the novelty of the program, you know. It's not every day that you get to see a museum literally on wheels that functions as a, in the setting and the way everything is prepared and looked, that is a gallery experience.
And it is a gallery experience. The inside of the trailer is anything but a trailer. The floor is a hardwood. The walls lined with a fuzzy covering. One wall complete with a bench for comfortable observing. And from the ceiling hang lights, aiming at the artwork, just as one would see in any museum. The Arkansas Art Center's Artmobile will be at Ramey Junior High in Fayetteville through this Friday. Over the weekend, it will make its way to the Baxter County Library. Lawrence says the public is welcome to visit, though you might be sharing the space with some students. This is Ozarks at Large. It is Wednesday, November 13th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Joining us now is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, there's got to be something good about this time of year, right?
Well, it's almost Christmas, almost Thanksgiving.
I like food.
Yeah.
How about eagles?
I also like eagles.
Oh, good, because that has nothing to do with food.
Oh, okay. Last Wednesday, Antoinette and I talked about eagles, so please tell us some more about eagles.
Well, it's time for the Eagle Watch cruises.
See, we were talking about this and how you always talk about it and how we need to go.
It's really fun, except the first time that we tried to go, it was really cold. Mm-hmm. And I ended up looking like the little kid in that Christmas play.
A Christmas Story?
Yeah. Couldn't even waddle. If I'd fallen over, I'd still be there. But if you go on a nice day, it's a beautiful chance to cruise Beaver Lake in a pontoon boat, 20 passengers. About 2 hours, look for eagles, which I don't believe I saw any of, but that's okay. Sometimes you see more. It's a gorgeous day on the lake. There's no food, unless you bring your own.
I can do that.
Okay. These tours happen at 3 o'clock most Saturdays and Sundays through February. They are offered by Hobbs State Park, and you can find out more and make your reservations by calling them at 789-5000.
We're going to have to do that this year.
I know. You mean 2014? Because we're running out of 2014.
Yeah, we are. We're going to be very busy until 2014. So.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, make a list for 2014.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hi, my name is Paul, your host for the Generic Blues Show, where local and international artists get showcased for over 22 years. You know, anymore, the blues casts a wide net. As new generations emerge, the look and the sound of the blues continues to evolve. Tune in every Friday night at 9 o'clock to see what I've captured next on listener-supported KUAF. We'll see you then.
November is National Philanthropy Month, a 30-day salute that grew from the first National Philanthropy Day that came from a proclamation signed by President Ronald Reagan in 1986. In Northwest Arkansas, the month is recognized today with an event sponsored by the Association of Fundraising Professionals Northwest Arkansas Chapter. To mark the observance of both the day and the month devoted to the practice of philanthropy, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellams used the subject as the basis for this month's edition of our Three Things segment, when we spend time asking an expert what three things we should know about a specific topic.
Allison McElroy is the Foundation Director at Open Avenues in Rogers. Open Avenues is a job training organization for people with disabilities.
So our mission is to empower adults with disabilities by providing employment, education, life skills training, and meaningful work.
To better serve that mission, Open Avenues relies on financial support from many different sources, from the United Way to private businesses and individuals. We asked Allison McElroy, a fundraising professional, what she thought all of us should know about philanthropy. The first thing?
How good it feels.
She says giving, helping support a cause, quite simply, makes a person feel better.
It's a gift that gives back to you because of, I mean, they might say running, you know, produces endorphins, but so does giving. It really does.
Allison cites personal experience as proof. Open Avenues had a multi-year capital campaign to raise money for a new facility.
When we first started, you know, it was very daunting and stressful, and are we ever, you know, will we ever be able to do this? Is it just a dream? And the more we pulled together, and I mean, the economy tanked. I mean, there was all kinds of things that happened during our campaign that would make someone maybe think, this is impossible. But we were like the little engine that could. And when we saw that it was actually going to happen, and when we got our land, and then we started seeing construction, and I mean, you could just see board members and people that were serving on the building campaign cabinet and people that had made pledges. You could just see the excitement and the, oh my goodness, this dream is really going to come true. And I had a part of that.
So giving money to a favored cause or causes can produce feelings of accomplishment, happiness, or even joy. Allison McElroy says a second thing we should know about philanthropy is knowledge that she says produces a sense of security. The Association of Fundraising Professionals, both nationally and locally, adheres to a set of ethical standards. Those standards, she says, should let donors feel confident that their contributions are being directed in the manner the donors expect.
So the ethics of fundraising, although you might hear, you know, still in the news about national organizations or small organizations that aren't following those ethical standards, you know, here in Northwest Arkansas and anyone else in the world that's associated with AFP, they have signed an ethical document and sort of an oath that they are going to practice ethical standards in fundraising and use the funds and or steward the funds like they're supposed to steward them. And there's not supposed to be any misappropriation or anything that's not on the table. There's a donor bill of rights where we talk about, you know, the rights as a donor. Your right is that you're supposed to know where that money is going that you've donated.
The AFP's existence in Northwest Arkansas has, she says, another positive effect. Fundraising professionals who discuss their profession build a better community of philanthropy region-wide. She says there is little rivalry among the members here.
We all feel more like we're in this together. What I've found that works for my agency might work really great for another agency, or it might not work for two different agencies might not be able to do the same thing. But we all seem to be in this together and truly knowing that the cause is the main focus. And so it's not really about which donors are going to give to who. You know, there are times we think, oh, no, the university just got all the money again, and we laugh, and it's always just a joke. But that's a joke that all fundraisers use, and educate people who are in education, they laugh too. I mean, it's, you know, education seems to always get all the donations is what we always used to say. But in our, even on the national level, when we all get together, it's about sharing and helping each other and encouraging each other, and knowing that if you're doing your job right, it's really not about competition.
If that seems counterintuitive, that people who are paid to raise money don't seem competitive in seeking money, Allison says it's because there is a strong belief that giving creates giving, and that a sense of philanthropy can, in a way, be contagious.
The ones that are giving to their cause aren't necessarily going to drop that cause and go to another cause. They might add another cause because maybe their family dynamic has changed, and maybe they didn't have anyone with a disability before, but they've just had a maybe a grandchild that's born with a disability, so now that's going to, you know, come into their realm of what they're going to give to. But it's once you realize it's not really competition, it's more of we're all in this together, and your job is to find the donor that fits, their passion fits your mission. And that's really what it's all about. And if you can find that donor that fits your mission, it's not something that you really worry about them leaving and going to someone else. If it happens and they do, I think most of us just there's usually circumstances and we understand why.
Finally, Allison says she wants people to know one more thing about philanthropy. You could call this the "you can't take it with you" rule of giving.
You're able to be philanthropic even after you've left this earth. And a lot of us are guilty of not thinking that way and thinking about having, you don't have to be, you know, a Tyson or a Walton or, you know, anybody that we foresee as people with lots of wealth. You can just be Allison or Kyle and work for that nonprofit and maybe not have all the resources of a Walton or a Tyson, but you can still leave your legacy and your mark on somebody, even just a percentage of what your estate is going to be. And I think we hear this all the time, that so many people do not plan for when they're gone, so someone else makes all the decisions for them. The government comes in and says, well, here's what we're going to do with your estate. When if you would just take that little bit of time to make some, you know, it's an uncomfortable situation to think about what's going to happen. But if you take that time and plan that, not only can you benefit your family first, maybe your religious organization, but then there's a little bit that you could chisel out for your favorite charity, and you could continue to bestow that good feeling and that and all those good works and help so many people even after you've been gone.
Much of any discussion about philanthropy revolves around, of course, financial contributions to an organization or cause. And a member of any nonprofit will tell you, yes, of course, the money is important. But volunteered time can also be an important element in a not-for-profit success story.
There are so many people that they might not have given financially at first, but they started, you know, when I think of volunteers, there's so many things that flash through my mind, but one that I thought of for here in Northwest Arkansas, you think of the Walton Arts Center. When you get there and you give someone your ticket, that's someone that's a volunteer. They're not even paid to be there until 12 o'clock that night, you know, checking you in and checking you out and making sure you find your seat. They've got this whole army of volunteers, and they just want to be involved, and they just want to do something.
Allison McElroy is the foundation director at Open Avenues in Rogers and a member of the Association of Fundraising Professionals Northwest Arkansas Chapter. November is National Philanthropy Month, and today the AFP chapter in Northwest Arkansas is observing their annual recognition of National Philanthropy Day with a luncheon and award ceremony at the Embassy Suites in Rogers. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Officials have announced construction of the University of Arkansas's Basketball Performance Center will officially begin early next month. The groundbreaking ceremony for the $25 million facility is scheduled for 11 a.m. Saturday, December 7th, at the future site of the Basketball Performance Center along Leroy Pond Road on the southeast corner of Bud Walton Arena between Bogle Park and the Gardens. Athletic Director Jeff Long, Arkansas Head Men's Basketball Coach Mike Anderson, and Arkansas Head Women's Basketball Coach Tom Collin will be among those taking part in the festivities. The groundbreaking ceremony is open to Razorback fans and members of the general public. The 66,000-square-foot facility is scheduled to open as the home of Razorback basketball in the summer of 2015. The Basketball Performance Center will house all operational components for the men's and women's basketball teams, including two full-court gymnasiums, men's and women's locker rooms, a weight room, an athletic training room, coaches' offices, team meeting rooms, student-athlete lounge, and study areas, and an equipment room. The University of Arkansas is currently the only Southeastern Conference program without a basketball practice facility. Following the Basketball Performance Center groundbreaking ceremony, Arkansas hosts Clemson in men's basketball at 1 o'clock. Later that evening, the Razorback women's team hosts Northwestern State at 7 o'clock. More information is available at ArkansasRazorbacks.com.
An exhibition titled Paul Rudolph, The Florida Houses, is now on display through January 10th at the Fred and Mary Smith Exhibition Gallery in Volwalker Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. This exhibition provides a critical introduction to a body of work that is relatively unknown to many architects today. According to a news release, most discussions of Rudolph's work revolve around the Art and Architecture Building at Yale University, set within the tumultuous context of the 1960s. But the major public and academic projects are actually the second important chapter in Rudolph's career. The early residential work in Florida, produced during a 20-year period, provided the necessary testing ground for Rudolph's developing design methodology. The houses in this exhibition were widely publicized at the time of their conception and played a significant role in the culture of mid-20th century American design. For more information, visit architecture.uark.edu.
The University of Arkansas Diane D. Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society in Fayetteville and the University of Arkansas Clinton School of Public Service in Little Rock will co-host a free screening of the PBS documentary project Makers, Women Who Make America at 7 p.m. Thursday in the Arkansas Union Theater. Sarah Evans, one of the project's advisors, will lead a discussion after the viewing, and a reception will follow the program. The film features interviews with more than 200 groundbreakers and organizers who challenged the status quo, including Christiane Amanpour, Judy Blume, Aaron Brockovich, Hillary Clinton, Mia Hamm, Danica Patrick, and Condoleezza Rice. The screening is part of the fifth symposium in the Blair Legacy series, 18 Million Cracks, The Legacy of Second Wave Feminism in American Politics. More information is available at blaircenter.uark.edu.
Mercy and PepsiCo have announced that four-time Grammy Award-nominated singer-songwriter Jewel will be the entertainer for the 20th annual Mercy Health Foundation Charity Ball. The event will take place Saturday, December 7th at the John Q. Hammonds Convention Center in Rogers. More information is available online at mercy.net. Sarah Palin will be in Fayetteville later this month as part of a book tour. Yesterday, Palin's new book, Good Tidings and Great Joy, Protecting the Heart of Christmas, arrived in stores, and she kicked off her book tour in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. November 21st, she will be at the Sam's Club in Fayetteville. This appearance and book signing is scheduled from 10 a.m. to noon. For more information about the book, visit harpercollins.com.
The Center for Business and Economic Research will welcome St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank President Jim Bullard as the speaker at the Quarterly Business Analysis Program this month. The event is scheduled for 11:30 a.m. Thursday, November 21st at the John Q. Hammonds Convention Center in Rogers. The program will last for approximately 60 minutes and will include time for questions and answers. The cost for the Quarterly Business Analysis Program and luncheon is $40. Pre-registration is required by Monday, November 18th. Reservations can be made by visiting uacs.uark.edu or by calling 575-4151.
The Foundation for Wellness Professionals will present a free workshop focused on balancing hormones naturally at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, December 3rd at the Rogers Public Library. Dr. Nathan Wagner will discuss a holistic, non-drug approach to women's hormone-related health concerns. Seating is limited, but reservations can be made by calling 899-6658.
While many farmers markets tend to shut down around this time each year, one local market is just getting started. Last week, Siloam Springs debuted its online farmers market. Stacy Hester, the market's manager, says they were planning on possibly starting a winter market next year, but that timetable got moved up after Meredith Bergstrom, executive director of Main Street Siloam Springs, learned about locallygrown.net earlier this year. After doing some research, Hester discovered hosting the Siloam Springs Farmers Market on this website was a viable option, and it officially opened on November 3rd. Hester also had to train vendors on how to use the site, and she says the online market was met with mixed reactions.
A lot of them, especially the younger vendors or the ones who are already familiar with using software, were very excited because this gave them an opportunity to earn some extra income through the winter. A lot of our farmers have not planted and grown things through the winter before. So we were talking about this in, probably July and August. We started talking about it and asking them if they would be willing to participate. And a few of them who had the greenhouses said, you know, this would be a really great thing for us to try. They planted things. We have had concerns with using the computer software. But once I sat down and we went through the training, they realized it was not difficult at all. They knew that I was, you know, a resource for them to contact if they needed help. And we had one of them actually go to their library because they didn't have a computer at home. They went to their library and logged on there and went through and set their stuff up and printed their orders and, you know, got everything ready without any problems.
Vendors are responsible for uploading their products to the market website, so they can include photos if they wish. Hester says vendors can also give descriptions of their products and set their own prices. Vendors also have the option of giving the exact amount or an estimated amount of product if they think they may have more ready by the pickup date. On the consumer side, the market is free to use, but patrons must first create an account. As of this week, Hester says more than 140 people have registered for a free account. Once patrons have signed into the website, they can shop and add products to their cart. The market is open from Sunday until 5 p.m. Wednesday. Vendors then have until Saturday morning to prepare their items. Patrons can then come pick up their purchases from 9 to 11 Saturday mornings at Wellspring Nutrition, which is located at 116 North Broadway. Hester says the market does not offer online transactions, so patrons can use cash and EBT SNAP benefits to pay for their purchases when they pick up their ordered items. Hester says the farmers market has seen quite a bit of growth in the last 2 years.
I would attribute it to the fact that Meredith came in to be the executive director of Main Street 3 years ago. And when she worked the farmers market, that was part of her job the first year, was to work the farmers market. She realized that even though it's been here for 15 years, that there was a lot more that we could do if it was better structured, if it was run more like a business as a whole, instead of just people setting up their own business in the park. And so she came up with some different guidelines and implemented them, and we've really worked, I only came this year, but she really worked with the vendors to help them learn how to promote their business and promote their products. And just be consistent in showing up and different things like that. And it's made a difference. We've done better as far as getting the word out to the community as well as what is offered.
15 vendors are participating in the online market and are selling a variety of goods. Some of the items patrons can purchase include beef, chicken, pork, baked goods, and vegetables like kale, lettuce, and winter squash. Vendors who participate in the market will be charged a 10% commission. An 8% surcharge will be added to a patron's purchase, and that money will help cover the expenses of running the market. If the online market goes well, Hester says they plan on continuing to offer it once the open-air market returns in April.
I feel that offering the products year-round keeps the community connected to supporting the local farmers. When you have several months off, you have to go find someplace to get what you need, and then you have to, you know, get back in the habit of coming back to the market when it opens. So if we're able to offer it year-round, it benefits the consumer and the farmer.
The Siloam Springs Online Farmers Market is open each week from Sunday until 5 p.m. Wednesday. Items may be picked up from 9 to 11 each Saturday morning at Wellspring Nutrition. Market organizers request that patrons bring bags or boxes to pack their purchases in. The open-air market will return in April. More information is available at silomsprings.locallygrown.net.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, Cleveland, a city hit hard by the foreclosure crisis, is now being stripped bare by scrappers.
A friend of mine was telling me they took her neighbor's car out of her driveway and they'll scrap these cars illegally.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Listen to Here and Now this afternoon from 1 to 3 on KUAF Public Radio.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice.
And speaking of the Women's Giving Circle, another grant from them has funded this next project. The Full Circle Campus Food Pantry is giving out 70 Thanksgiving dinner baskets starting on Monday, November 18th. That's this coming Monday. The baskets include frozen turkeys, dressing, cranberry sauce, and green bean casserole mix. The pickup dates for the baskets are from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Monday, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Thursday, November 21st, and from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday, November 25th. Anyone with a valid university ID can sign up. The baskets are part of Full Circle's Baskets of Hope program to help families in need. The program is funded by an $8,250 grant received from the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle. The program also includes three other seasonal baskets that the pantry will put out in the next academic year: winter holiday baskets, spring cleaning baskets, and summer family picnic baskets. To sign up for your basket, you can come to the pantry during its open hours, Mondays 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. and Thursdays 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And you can sign the list or contact the pantry at pantry@uark.edu. And you need to sign up for all of this before tomorrow. The deadline is tomorrow.
That's soon.
Mm-hmm. So get on that.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Evansville.
Evansville. I don't know where that is.
It is in western Washington County.
Western.
Yeah, so far west, it is almost on the Arkansas-Oklahoma border.
Okay. So that would be why I'm not familiar.
Right. On tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large, we continue our What's in a Name series,
right,
and talk about where some of the towns in Washington County get their names.
Perfect.
And Evansville is actually one of them.
Can you tell me where Evans will get
well,
his name?
Well, I can. Evans, I can't remember his first name, but Evans was the first sheriff of Washington County.
Very cool. Well, I look forward to that. I'm always interested in some of the names that we see on a map or that I hear in people's conversations, just sort of where that came from. So I'm looking forward to that story.
Yes. Yeah.
It's tomorrow on Ozarks at Large. The few more notes before we wrap up today. The Lowell Historical Museum will host a come-and-go open house for the public December 20th from 5 to 7 p.m. You can come enjoy an old-fashioned Christmas as children from the Lowell Elementary School will be singing at 1 p.m. as an early event to the open house. Then the Breaking Silence Band will perform at the museum from 5 to 7. Santa will give bags of candy to the children on a first-come, first-served basis. For more information, you can go to Lowell, Arkansas.
And Typo Fest is an event celebrating 10 years of Typo Magazine. This fest will take place November 22nd and 23rd in Fayetteville. A two-day literary event will include a reading, a talk, and a question and answer session with translator Guillermo Parra discussing Venezuelan poetry. Adam Clay will also talk about parent writing with their children, and Anne Boyer and Sandra Simmons will present a program as well. The event is being sponsored by Art Amiss. For more, visit their website, artamiss.org.
The Northwest Arkansas Land Trust presents The Big Sit, a bird-watching tailgate party, November 16th from 2 to 4:30 p.m. at the Wilson Springs Conservation Area in Fayetteville. It's a time to enjoy the land, watch for birds, record what you see, and share time outdoors with friends. For more information, you can visit nwalandtrust.org.
One quick event, the Dale Bumpers College of Agriculture, Food, and Life Sciences Department at the Animal Sciences Equine Program at the University of Arkansas will host its 13th annual Razorback Roundup Horse and Tack Auction on November 16th. That's at 1 p.m. in Fayetteville. Visit razorbackroundup.org.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back alongside her co-host, Kyle Kellums. Until then, have a happy Wednesday.
Thanks for listening.